Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. Massachusetts, this is Democracy Now! The far-right founder of the Oath Keepers, Stuart Rhodes, has been sentenced to 18 years in prison for seditious conspiracy for his role in the January 6th insurrection. We'll get the latest. Then we hear from Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones and Oscar-winning filmmaker Spike Lee on the legacy of Malcolm X, the making of the film, and the power of history.
Our ancestors risked their life because they understood that education was going to be the key. Our ancestors risked their life to be educated. We cannot let that go.
There's a reason we're the only people in the history of the United States for whom it was ever illegal to learn to read and write. Because we know, right, that education leads to liberation. And you can't keep people down who understand their history.
Plus, we look back at the 1937 Memorial Day massacre in Chicago.
On Memorial Day in 1937, striking workers at Republic Steel in South Chicago gathered for a picnic. When union activists marched towards the plant, police attacked. Why were 10 workers killed, and why was the only film footage of the tragedy hidden from the public? Lessons for workers and the media still resonate today.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The White House says it's nearing a deal to avert a default on the national debt less than a week before the Treasury Department says it'll run out of money. As part of a deal to raise the debt ceiling, House Republicans have been insisting on large cuts to domestic programs, coupled with increases in spending on the military and at the southern U.S. border. Under an emerging plan, Republicans led by Kevin McCarthy, the House Speaker, would agree to raise the debt limit for 2 years in exchange for strict caps on non-military discretionary spending. President Biden said he's optimistic he'll strike a deal before the June 1st deadline.
I made clear time and again defaulting on our national debt is not an option. The American people deserve to know that the Social Security payments will be there. The veterans' hospitals remain open, and that economic progress will be made, and we're going to continue to make it. Default puts all that at risk.
On Sunday, President Biden said he'd already proposed more than $1 trillion in cuts to federal discretionary spending, but Reuters reports the White House and House Republicans still remain about $70 billion apart. Republicans are pushing a proposal that would slash $10 billion in funding for the Internal Revenue Service to hire thousands of new agents. Meanwhile, environmentalists are warning the emerging deal would substantially weaken the National Environmental Policy Act in order to fast-track federal review of permits for new energy projects. It's a move favored by conservative Democratic Senator Joe Manchin that's previously faced a number of defeats in Congress. Friends of the Earth responded in a statement, quote, "Once again, lawmakers are expected to make the unconscionable decision to tack unpopular and environmentally harmful policies onto a must-pass bill." South Korea and the U.S. held their largest ever live-fire military exercises Thursday, and what they say is preparation for any full-scale attack from North Korea amidst mounting tensions on the Korean Peninsula. Officials say another four drills will take place in the coming weeks. This came just days after South Korea and the European Union agreed to increase security cooperation. This is EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen.
Just like we do not accept Russia's military aggression against Ukraine, we condemn the DPRK's constant nuclear saber rattling. We stand firmly by the Republic of Korea.
Meanwhile, North Korea labeled plans by South Korea, the U.S., and Japan to share real-time data on North Korean missile launches as sinister. In Paris, French riot police deployed tear gas and pepper sprays. Hundreds of climate activists converged on the Total Energies shareholder meeting earlier today. Investors are voting on a resolution to make accelerated emissions cuts in line with the French government's climate goals, a measure opposed by Total's board. The protests in Paris come days after activists in London disrupted Shell's annual shareholders meeting. Here in the United States, the Supreme Court has sharply limited the authority of the Environmental Protection Agency to protect and preserve wetlands under the Clean Water Act, a landmark half-century-old environmental law. Thursday's 5-4 opinion, written by Justice Samuel Alito, effectively ends protections for about half of all the wetlands in the contiguous United States. Conservation groups called the ruling a devastating setback for clean water and called on Congress to pass new legislation protecting wetlands. This is White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
The court's decision today aims to take our country backwards. It will jeopardize the sources of clean drinking water for farmers, businesses, and millions of Americans. Look, the Clean Water Act is the reason why America's lakes today are swimmable, why we can fish in our streams and rivers, and why safe drinking water comes out of our taps.
Indiana's state medical board has reprimanded and fined an Indianapolis doctor who publicly disclosed she'd performed an abortion on a 10-year-old rape survivor from Ohio last year. A majority of the board found Dr. Caitlin Bernard violated privacy laws by speaking about the girl's case, fining her $3,000. At Thursday's hours-long disciplinary hearing, Dr. Bernard explained why she decided to speak out.
I think that it's incredibly important for people to understand the real world impacts of the laws of this country about abortion or otherwise. I think it's important for people to know what patients will have to go through because of legislation that is being passed.
Indiana's Republican Attorney General Todd Rokita launched an investigation into Bernard last year after she came forward calling her unfit to practice medicine and urging the board to take disciplinary action against her. Abortion is still legal in Indiana up to 22 weeks of pregnancy. The founder of the far-right Oath Keepers militia group, Stuart Rhodes, has been sentenced to 18 years in prison on charges of seditious conspiracy over his role in the deadly January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. It's the longest sentence handed down so far for anyone tied to the insurrection. One of Rhodes' associates, Kelly Meggs, received a 12-year sentence for seditious conspiracy. We'll have more on this story after headlines. In Minneapolis, community members gathered Thursday for a vigil at the intersection where George Floyd was murdered 3 years ago by police officers. A day-long festival and concert are planned for Saturday. Other cities around the country also held memorials and protests. In related news, The Guardian reports U.S. cities will pay at least $80 million to racial justice protesters who were violently attacked by police in various incidents during the Black Lives Matter uprising following Floyd's killing in 2020. That number, already record-breaking, is expected to go up as pending lawsuits are resolved. In New York City, protesters, activists, and dozens of groups are calling on the city council to disband the NYPD's Strategic Response Group, which is engaged in brutal attacks on demonstrators. Scores of New Yorkers testified this week, including organizer Isabel Leva.
During the more than 200 protests that I have documented at since 2020, myself with my two eyes, I have seen the SRG use barricades to break limbs. I have seen the SRG kettle protesters and pummel trapped people with batons and fists. I have seen the SRG hold a taser to the head of an unhoused man while clearing Washington Square Park after curfew. I have seen the SRG use their bicycles like baseball bats, swinging them at people's heads. I have seen the SRG stand on top of cars and swing their batons at the crowd below. I have seen the SRG pile on top of protesters as they scream, "I can't breathe."
A Mississippi family is demanding accountability after a police officer shot an 11-year-old black boy who'd called 911 for help. Adarian Murray's mother had given him a cell phone and asked him to call the police during a domestic disturbance with the father of another one of her children. Nicola Murray, describe what happened when Officer Greg Capers arrived at the scene in the early hours of Saturday morning.
He was like, come out with your hands up. At that moment is when my son came out. To come out with their hands up, but you're shooting. I don't understand. I don't want to die. That's what he was saying while I was on the ground. I said, you're not going to die, baby. You're not going to die. Just keep talking.
Adarian Murray was released from the hospital on Wednesday after being treated for a collapsed lung, fractured ribs, and lacerated liver. Migrants, and finally, in the Mediterranean, humanitarian aid workers are continuing to search for a boat carrying hundreds of migrants that's been missing since Wednesday morning. The boat was reportedly adrift with no working engine in the middle of the sea between the northern Libyan coast and the Italian island of Sicily. This is Albert Mardomo with the Italian humanitarian aid group Emergency NGO speaking from aboard the rescue vessel Life Support.
On board, there are 500 people, including 45 women, also pregnant, and 56 children, one born on board. We tried our best to find these people, and we will look for them until tonight. Unfortunately, after 32 hours of navigation to reach the distress and 24 hours of active search, we still have not found them. However, it is unacceptable that NGOs and not coastal states defend lives in the Mediterranean Sea. We asked Malta and Italy to take on the operations responsibility, but they refused to share any information.
In related news in France, five soldiers have been criminally charged, accused of refusing to rescue a group of migrants, resulting in the deaths of 27 people as they crossed the English Channel in a small boat in November 2021. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Cambridge, Massachusetts. The far-right founder of the Oath Keepers, Stuart Rhodes, has been sentenced to 18 years in prison for seditious conspiracy for plotting to keep Donald Trump in power after the 2020 election, resulting in the deadly January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. It's the longest sentence handed down so far for anyone tied to the insurrection. One of Rhodes' associates, Kelly Meggs, who led the Florida chapter of the Oath Keepers, was sentenced Thursday to 12 years in prison. A jury had convicted both men of seditious conspiracy in November. Following Joe Biden's defeat of Trump in November 2020, Rhodes told his followers, quote, "We are not getting through this without a civil war," unquote. Federal prosecutors had accused Rhodes of playing a key role in planning the January 6th insurrection, even though he did not enter the Capitol. Prosecutors described him as a, quote, "general overlooking a battlefield while his troops stormed inside." During Thursday's sentencing, Stuart Rhodes wore an orange prison jumpsuit and claimed he was a political prisoner. Judge Amit Mehta rebuked Rhodes, saying, quote, "What we absolutely cannot have is a group of citizens who, because they did not like the outcome of the election, were then prepared to take up arms in order to foment a revolution. That's what you did," the judge said. The Justice Department had sought a 25-year sentence. We're joined now by Kristen Durer. She's an independent journalist covering right-wing extremism. Kristen, first respond to this verdict, both for Stuart Rhodes and talk about who he is and his associate.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, this was a very substantial win for democracy. This was 18 years is a very long time for Stuart Rhodes to be in prison. And it's strong. It sends a strong message of deterrence to anybody else who is considering trying to overthrow the government again in 2024 or in, you know, future years. So Stuart Rhodes is the leader of the far-right Oath Keepers organization. And so the Oath Keepers is an anti-government extremist organization founded in 2009. And they have this idea that they're protecting the United States from the federal government. And so they have always, you know, been willing and ready to defy the federal government. And they have heavily recruited from military, former military members, and police officers. And they have had as many as 40,000 people on their membership rolls, though likely they've only had a few thousand people as members at a time. And I will say that they've always been very conspiratorial in tone, and they, you know, leaders of the Oath Keepers, like Stuart Rhodes, have suggested that the federal government has been taken over by global elites, and that they want to put Americans in concentration camps. So this is a very conspiratorial, far-right, extremist anti-government organization.
I mean, this is the most severe and longest penalty of over 1,000 criminal cases stemming from the Capitol attack.
Yes, this is the most, this is the longest sentence. Before that, it was one other man who had, I think, up to 32 prior convictions and had assaulted police officers, and he was given 14 years. And Kelly Meggs, who you mentioned earlier, the leader of the Florida chapter of the Oath Keepers, was sentenced to 12 years, which is now the third longest. This really sends a strong message of deterrence. And it also sends a message to those who are still waiting for their sentencing, who have been convicted of seditious conspiracy.
Can you talk about the fact that Stuart Rhodes wore that orange prison jumpsuit and the fact that he is saying he is a political prisoner, what he said in the courtroom?
Yeah, so this is exactly what he's been doing since he's been in prison. You know, he has said that he is a political prisoner, and I don't want to mess up this quote, so let me just take a quick look at it. But that he promised to, quote, expose the criminality of this regime while he is in prison. And these are still things that he has said during his time waiting to be sentenced. You know, he has said that the election was stolen, which it was not. And he has, you know, said that his only crime is having different political views. But we very well know that he was plotting and planning for a violent overthrow of the U.S. government, and he was just waiting for Trump to invoke the Insurrection Act before they brought weapons to the Capitol.
According to the New York Times, it's also this sentencing is the first to be increased for fitting the legal definition of terrorism.
Yeah. So, you know, this is something that I think prosecutors were going after when they were seeking that 25-year sentencing. You know, seditious conspiracy holds a charge of 20 years. And so, you know, this was something that prosecutors was trying to put, Stuart Rhodes in jail for a longer period of time. And this is something that, you know, the judge, recognized.
During a recent town hall, CNN town hall, former President Trump said if he's elected again, he'd be inclined to pardon many of the insurrectionists. The CNN host, Caitlin Collins, also asked Trump if he had any regrets about his actions on January 6th. This was his response.
January 6th, it was the largest crowd I've ever spoken to. That was prior to the walk down to the Capitol building. I don't think, and I've spoken to hundreds of thousands of people, I've never spoken to a crowd as large as this. And that was because they thought the election was rigged. And they were there proud. They were there with love in their heart. That was an unbelievable, and it was a beautiful day. And what I was asked to do, I wasn't involved in it very much. I was asked to come in. Would I make a speech? I made a speech. I said, walk peacefully and patriotically, or, you know, many different things.
Can you respond to this, Kristen Doerr?
Yeah, it's a bit, it's unsurprising in some ways. I mean, we saw immediately after January 6th, Trump, you know, or even during January 6th, Trump not wanting to tell the protesters to go home. He has always remained very loyal to those who are unapologetically and loudly for him. And I think he saw, you know, the Oath Keepers as tools, as allies in a certain sense. And I think he also, you know, is going to say that he's going to pardon these people whom he calls political prisoners in an effort to hold on to his base and to, you know, gin up enthusiasm. There's been a major rewrite among the far right and among even, you know, the Republican Party to, you know, rewrite January 6th into not a national tragedy, but a political protest that got out of hand.
Now, the far right likes to call this an inside job, what happened on the day, on the January 6th insurrection. The FBI reportedly got a tip about Oath Keepers' plans for armed fight in November of 2020. This was well before January 6th. We just have 30 seconds. Why wasn't this stopped then?
You know, this is one of the most frustrating things. You know, even right-wing extreme researchers for counter-extremism researchers and reporters have been seeing this violent rhetoric, this, you know, all this activity around January 6th. And, you know, there was bad communications, it appears, between the different government agencies. And there were certain people who didn't take these threats seriously. And that's something that we've seen time and time again, where when it comes to right-wing extremists, those threats are not always taken seriously.
Well, Kristen Doerr, I want to thank you for being with us, independent journalist covering right-wing extremism. Coming up, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones and the Oscar-winning filmmaker Spike Lee on the legacy of Malcolm X, the making of the film, and the power of history. Stay with us. Son, music from the movie Do the Right Thing, composed by Bill Lee, the father of Spike Lee. Bill died on Wednesday at the age of 94. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As attacks on the teaching of Black history escalate in Florida and other states, we turn to two of the nation's most acclaimed storytellers, the Oscar-winning filmmaker Spike Lee and the journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, who won a Pulitzer Prize for her work on the 1619 Project. They both spoke last Friday on the birthday of Malcolm X at the Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz Memorial and Education Center, which is housed in the former Audubon Ballroom in New York, where Malcolm X was assassinated in 1965. Last Friday marked what would have been Malcolm's 98th birthday. We begin with Nicole Hannah-Jones.
I was a sophomore in high school when I first read the autobiography of Malcolm X, and it was one of those three transformative texts in my life. I could never see myself as a Black person the same after reading that text. A year later, I sat in a movie theater in Waterloo, Iowa, captivated by Mr. Lee's brilliant storytelling in Malcolm X. And to this day, anybody who knows me...
Say Denzel Washington.
Anybody who knows me knows that's my favorite movie. I've watched that movie so many times, and I just was watching it recently on Delta. And if you go into the newspaper archives of the Waterloo Courier, you will see a young Nicole Hannah-Jones with a Malcolm X, an X medallion on, after I'd led the walkout of my school demanding Black history be taught to all students at our high school. So So I'm honored to be here with you tonight and to stand in this room, in this very room in 1964, where Malcolm X said, Plymouth Rock did not land on us, the rock was landed on us, right? And I would never imagine that one day I would be standing here right now trying to tell the story of another ship that arrived a year before, the Mayflower. The same year I read Malcolm X's book, I read another book by a historian called Lerone Bennett, and that book was called Before the Mayflower. And it told the story of not 1620, but 1619. And we know every American child learns that story of the Mayflower, and yet the story of another ship called the White Lion has been erased from the story of America because we like to tell the stories that glorify our country, and we want to hide those ugly parts. I realized at that moment, as a 16-year-old child, that history is not simply what happened, on what day, and who did it, but what powerful people want us to remember about what happened. And so what we commonly call history is actually memory. And that memory in the United States has been shaped too often by white men in power who want us to remember the history of a country that never existed. My work is to ensure that before you ever learn about the Mayflower in 1620, you're going to learn about that ship in 1619 called the White Lion. You're going to learn about our stories of resistance, of the contributions of Black Americans, and we will not be erased from the narrative of the country that our ancestors built. So to stand here in this very space, on this hallowed ground, is an incredible honor. I am an honor to be here with all of the honorees tonight. And I think about that book 30 years ago, how my life has been inspired by Malcolm X, inspired by Lerone Bennett, inspired by all of the truth tellers. And then we see why they're trying to ban our history, right? Because once you learn your history, you don't accept your place. Once you learn your history, you challenge the way the power is wielded against the vulnerable. So that's why they want to outlaw our history, because history will radicalize us. History will open our eyes. There's a reason we're the only people in the history of the United States for whom it was ever illegal to learn to read and write. Because we know, right, that education leads to liberation. And you can't keep people down who understand their history. So I promise you all tonight, I will try to uphold the great legacy of one of our most ardent truth tellers, a man who stood up to power all across this nation. And as long as I have breath, they won't bury our history. We will tell the truth. Thank you.
New York Times journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, who won a Pulitzer Prize for her work on the 1619 Project, speaking last Friday at the Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz Memorial and Educational Center in New York at an event to mark what would have been Malcolm X's 98th birthday. The acclaimed filmmaker Spike Lee gave the keynote address. He talked about the making of his 1992 film, more than 30 years ago, Malcolm X, as well as his family and the power of education. Just days after this event, Spike Lee's father, the bassist and composer Bill Lee, died at the age of 94 at his home in Brooklyn. Bill Lee had a prolific musical career, performing with legendary artists including Harry Belafonte, Aretha Franklin, Odetta, John Lee Hooker, and Bob Dylan. He also wrote the scores to many of his son Spike Lee's films, including Do the Right Thing and Mo Better Blues. This is Spike Lee speaking last Friday.
I'm not a keynote speaker. I'm going to say what I got to say, and that'll be it. The most important book I ever read was The Autobiography of Malcolm X. Seventh grade, Rothschild Junior High School, in the People's Republic of Brooklyn, New York. Is Brooklyn in the house? All right. It's Harlem. All right. That's it. That's it. We're not doing it. That's it. You know what, though? Can we have a moment of silence for Mr. Harry Belafonte and Mr. Jim Brown, who passed today, too? Some of you might have heard that Jim Brown passed away today. Freedom fighters, That's what they are. And they'll be looking down on us, what we're doing. When I read Dorbar